cake. We hope you'll be able to do it. Timothy said we'll pay top dollar. Cynthia was astounded to hear Esther Bullock burst into tears, followed by a pause, in which there was considerable murmuring and shuffling about.
"Hello?" Jean bawled into the phone. "Esther said tell you she'd love to bake your wedding cake, and no charge. You tell the father, no charge."
Now his choir was upset because the crowd from down the street had horned in. Had he actually agreed to such a plan? He remembered only that Mike had brought it up, nothing more. He called Mike Stovall. "I believe we talked about your choir joining our choir for..."
"Right, and everything's going great, just great. We got a couple of ideas for the music."
"The music, of course, is entirely Richard's domain, Richard's and Cynthia's. So,
well..."
Mike Stovall sounded annoyed. "In any case, given the small quarters of our nave and chancel, I think it might be best to..."
"Oh, we've thought that through, Father. Here's the deal. Your choir in the chancel, ours in the rear. What do you think?"
He couldn't think. He needed a job foreman. Somebody in a hard hat.
"It will be September, you know."
Hesse Mayhew, Mitford Muse reporter and gifted flower arranger, had come to consult with Cynthia in the rectory living room. As Father Tim served them lemonade and shortbread, he couldn't help but listen. After all, wasn't he a gardener? Wasn't he interested in flowers? He crept to a corner of the room with a glass of lemonade and appeared to be wholly absorbed in scratching his dog behind the ears.
"And in September," said Hesse, "there's precious little that's worth picking."
Hesse had staked her reputation on what she foraged from meadow and pasture, roadside and bank. Her loose, informal bouquets were quite the hit at every spring and summer function, and her knowledge of where the laciest wild carrot bloomed and the showiest hydrangeas grew was both extensive and highly secret. However, as autumn drew on, the blooms began to vanish. She hedged her bets. By dashing cold water on her client's heady expectations, she was usually able to come up with something agreeably breathtaking.
"What does this mean?" asked Cynthia, looking worried. "It means that what we mostly have to deal with is pods."
"Pods?" His fiancée was aghast. Hesse shrugged. "Pods, seeds, berries," she said, expanding the list of possibilities.
"Unless you'd like mums."
Hesse said this word with undisguised derision. "Mums." He noted that the very word made his neighbor blanch. Cynthia looked his way, imploring. But he did not make eye contact. No, indeed, he would not get in the middle of a discussion about pods and berries, much less mums.
"Pods and berries can be wonderful," Hesse stated, as if she were the full authority, which she was. "Mixed with what's blooming and tied in enormous bunches, they can look very rich, hanging on the pew ends. Of course, we'll use wide ribbons. I suggest French wired velvet, possibly in sage, and even something the color of the shoemake berry."
As a bow to tradition, Hesse enjoyed using the mountain pronunciation for sumac. He stole a glance at Cynthia from the corner of his eye. How had that gone down? She seemed uncertain.
"Why can't we just order dozens of roses and armloads of lilacs and be done with it?"
Hesse sucked in her breath.
"Well," she said, "if you want to spend that kind of money..."
And let the word get out that his bride was a spendthrift? That was Hesse's deeper meaning. He knew Hesse Mayhew like a book. He knew, too, that Hesse considered the ordering of lilacs in September to be something akin to criminal. Not only would they cost a royal fortune, they were out of season in the mountains.
"Not to mention," said Hesse, pursing her lips, "they're out of season in the mountains."
"Excuse me for living," said his fiancée. "Anyway, we don't want to spend that kind of money." In truth, his bride-to-be had the capability to spend whatever she wished, being a successful children's book author and illustrator. Besides, thought the rector, wasn't it her wedding?
Wasn't it their money to spend however they liked?
He hunkered down in the chair, anonymous, invisible, less than a speck on the wall.
Cynthia heaved a sigh. So, Hesse, whatever you think, sage and burgundy, or let's call it claret, shall we? Burgundy sounds so heavy. Do you think we should intermix the ribbon colors along the aisle, or put sage on one side and claret on the other?
The color deepened in Hesse's ample cheeks.
Sage for the bride's side and claret for the groom's side is my opinion.
Of course, I don't have any family for the bride's side, only a nephew who isn't really a nephew, and the last I heard he was in the Congo.
His heart was touched by the small sadness he heard in her voice, and so apparently was Hesse's.
"Oh, but you do have family!" Hesse threw her head back, eyes flashing.
"The entire parish is your family!"
Cynthia pondered this extravagant remark. "Do you really think so?"
"Think so!" boomed Hesse. "I know so! You're the brightest thing to happen to Lord's Chapel in an eon, and you must not forget it, my dear, as we certainly won't."
Mitford's erstwhile floral designer, newspaper columnist, and all-around go-getter patted Cynthia's arm with considerable feeling. Click! Something wonderful had just taken place. Hesse Mayhew, sensitive to the bone underneath her take-charge manner, had for some reason decided to be his fiancée's shield and buckler from this moment on. And nobody messed with Hesse.
"We'll feel every pew on the bride's side," Hesse predicted. "We'll be falling over ourselves to sit there. It's certainly where I'm sitting. No offense, Father."
Cynthia took Hesse's rough hand. "Thank you, Hesse."
"Thank you, Lord," he thought, forsaking his invisibility by bolting from the chair to refill their glasses all around.
"And what," inquired Hesse, "are you planning to do, Father, other than show up?"
Hesse Mayhew was smiling, but he knew she was dead serious.
Hesse believed that every man, woman, and child, including the halt and lame, should participate in all parish-wide events to the fullest. "I'm doing the usual," he said, casting a grin in the direction of his neighbor. "I'm baking a ham."
Chapter 4 The Bishop. Gone to seed is how the rector once fondly described his rectory home of more than 13 years. Puny's eagerness to keep the place fastidious had, he was certain, worn away at least a stratum of walnut on the highboy, a gram or two of wool on the aubusson, and a millimeter of sterling on the tea service. She was now feverishly removing another layer from the whole caboodle in preparation for any celebration that may be held in the rectory, since, she said, Cynthia's house was too small to cuss a cat. No offense to Violet. Nearly overcome by the odor of lemon pledge, he went to the phone and dialed his neighbor.
"Want to bring your notebook and go to the park?"
"I'll race you," she said.
They sat on the bench and listened for a moment to the birds, and a light wind that stirred the leaves in Baxter Park. He kissed her, lingering. She kissed him back, lingering still more. She drew away and fanned herself with the notebook, laughing.
"On to more serious matters," he exclaimed. "First order of business, pew bulletin or invitations. What do you think?"
"Pew bulletin. That way, everybody knows, and those few who aren't in the parish will call. I'll try to reach David, though I can't imagine he'd trek all the way from the Congo to Mitford."
"Where shall we put Walter and Catherine, your place or mine?"
"First things first," she said. "We need to know where we're spending our wedding night."
"The rectory."
"But, darling, your bed is so small."
"Yes, but your bed is so big. In his view, they could hold a fox hunt on the vast territory she called a bed."
"Draw straws," she said, leaning from the bench to pluck two tall spears of grass. She fiddled with them a moment, asked him to close his eyes, then presented them in her fist.
"Gambling again," he said.
Long one my house, short one your house.
He drew the short one. Rats in a poke, fumed his neighbor. Watch your language, Kavanaugh.
Isn't it a tad early to call me Kavanaugh?
I'm practicing.
Anyway, there's your answer. Walter and Catherine spend the night at my house.
Done. He checked the topic off his list. Have you thought any more about flower girls?
Amy Larkin and Rebecca Owen.
Perfect. Music?
Richard and I are just beginning to work on it. Let's definitely ask Dooley to sing.
Splendid. Should have thought of it myself.
A cappella.
He doesn't go for a cappella.
He'll get over it, darling, I promise. And it will be wonderful. A true highlight for everyone. Oh, perfect love. What do you think?
There won't be a dry eye in the house. By the way, we're scheduled for the bishop on Wednesday at 11 o'clock.
What are you wearing? She asked.
Oh, something casual. A pink curler in my hair, perhaps.
She swatted his arm over this old joke. I love you madly, she said.
I love you madlier.
Do not.
Do too.
Prove it.
I shall. I'm serving you dinner tonight. Puny made chicken and dumplings.
Chicken and dumplings, she crowed.
With fresh lima beans.
I'm your slave.
I'll remember that, he said.
He felt the same age he usually felt at Miss Sadie's house. Here he was, in his bishop's office, seated next to his sweetheart, and only minutes away they'd be talking about sex. He felt the blood surge to his head, coloring his face like a garden tomato. Though he was the priest, presumably competent to discuss a wide variety of personal issues, it was, in fact, Cynthia, who felt perfectly at ease, talking about anything to anybody, any time. They were currently in the touchy area of financial, always the leading subject on Stewart's program for premarital counseling. Thus far, they were in good shape, having discussed some days ago what Stewart called his bottom line on the issue. Consult with the other about significant purchases, be open about your assets and willing to share equally, and agree on a budget that puts God first.
And how do you feel, Timothy, about having a wife whose income is significantly greater than your own?
Blast! Why couldn't Stewart have the discretion to avoid this issue? He and Cynthia had discussed it, but he hadn't been completely candid with her. He hesitated, hating this moment for both of them.
Not good, he said at last.
Cynthia looked at him. Did he see hurt or surprise or both? God brought us together, he said. He knew what he was doing. And if he doesn't mind the inequity in what I bring to the marriage, then I know I'm not to mind it either. But sometimes I do. Please understand that I don't resent her greater assets. Not in the least. Cynthia Coppersmith is the hardest working, most deserving woman I've ever known. The problem, if there is one, is that... He paused. What was the problem? Hadn't he pondered this on several sleepless nights? The problem, said Cynthia, is loss of control. Isn't that it, dearest? You feared a loss of control all along, from the beginning. And now I'm the one who could buy a new car or take us to Spain.
I don't want to go to Spain, he said, feeling suddenly vulnerable, close to tears.
He also didn't want a new car. He was perfectly happy with the old one. Stewart smiled.
If you're all that God wishes you to be in marriage, you will be one flesh. The money must belong to you equally, Timothy. In your heart, you must be able to accept it, not as money you've worked for and earned, but as money God means you to have in stewardship with your wife.
Cynthia leaned over and kissed him on the cheek. Tears sprang instantly to his eyes and escaped to the sides of his nose before he could press them with a handkerchief.
I think, he said, that I'm... overwhelmed on every side. I still can't think why God should give me this tremendous blessing. A gracious and loving soul who comprehends the depth of my own soul completely. And then to add, financial resources beyond my wildest dreams. He lifted his hands. In truth, money means very little to me. I've lived simply all my life and can't imagine doing otherwise.
You've been exceedingly generous to others, said Stuart. For example, you've poured your personal revenues into the children's hospital for years. Now, Timothy, you must allow someone to be generous with you, if she so chooses.
I so choose, Cynthia patted the rector's arm.
Relieved, they all had a sip of water from glasses waiting on a tray.
Another crucial issue, said Stuart, is in-laws.
We won't have any, Cynthia crowed.
Stuart smiled paternally.
In truth, you will.
We will.
According to the Lord's Chapel membership register, there are 183 of them, which roughly translates to a mere 125 active in-laws.
His fiancée appeared vexed, to say the least.
Yes, and there are some who can't bear the sight of me anymore. Everything was just fine until...
Until they learned you were getting married. Then the jealousy flooded in. They were there first. They got his undivided attention for years. Now it must be divided.
Ugh, she said.
What I hope you'll be able to live with is that his attention to you will also be divided. Like them, you'll have to share your priest. Unlike them, you must also share your beloved, your sweetheart.
Stuart looked fondly at Cynthia.
If anyone can do this, you're the one.
Thank you, she said. Pray for me.
Martha and I have prayed for you since the day Timothy brought you to lunch. We both thought you possessed the most extraordinary light. It reflected upon our friend like a beacon. We thank you for that.
The rector noted with a pang of tenderness that his fiancée blushed deeply, something he rarely witnessed.
I've always felt it takes especially noble character to be a clergy spouse, said Stuart. In any case, you and they will soon grow accustomed to sharing him. It's all a process, a matter of time and patience and love. I know you're willing.
Yes, she said. Oh, yes.
The bishop folded his hands across his lean midsection and gazed at his visitors.
Here it comes, thought the rector. Do you pray together? Asked Stuart.
Yes, they said in unison.
Every evening, volunteered Father Tim.
Excellent. I'm reminded of what our friend Oswald Chambers said, that prayer doesn't fit us for the greater work. Prayer is the greater work. Praying together affirms you as one flesh, and among the endless benefits it bestows, it can greatly enhance your sexual communication.
A patch of light danced upon the worn Persian carpet, reflecting the branches of a dogwood tree outside the window.
The highest form of prayer is one in which we don't beg for ourselves, said Stuart, but seek to know what we can do for God. This delights God immensely. As you seek to know what you can do for the other, you will surely receive your own inexpressible delight.
The rector took Cynthia's hand.
To put it simply, making love confirms your spiritual relationship, and your spiritual relationship will deepen your lovemaking. It all moves in a wondrous circle.
The rector and his neighbor drew a deep breath at precisely the same moment and looked at each other, laughing.
Now, said Stuart.
Now what?
Asked Father Tim. Conflict resolution.
Do we have to?
Asked Cynthia.
Have you had any conflicts?
The two looked at each other.
His car,
she said.
What about my car? Queried the rector. Don't you remember?
I said it was a gas guzzler, has rust, and the seat covers look like Puny's dish rags. And I said I'm perfectly satisfied with it. There. The bishop wanted conflict. He got conflict. The rector felt his collar suddenly tighten. And so, Cynthia told Stuart, when we drive on the parkway or visit our bishop, we take my car. How do you feel about that? She wrinkled her nose. She stared briefly at the ceiling. She smiled. I can live with it. Stuart chuckled. He had his own opinion of his priest's car, but far be it from him to comment.
It's terrific that you're willing to name the conflict, my dear. This equips us to attack the problem instead of attacking the other person.
Stuart sat back in his chair.
So, Timothy, how do you feel about driving her car instead of yours?
Good, he said, meaning it.
I can live with it.
He pressed Cynthia's hand and turned to look at her. She appeared to sparkle in some lovely way he'd never seen before. After his brief moment of righteous indignation, he was custard again. On the way home in her Mazda, he noticed that she looked at him fondly more than once. Sweetie pie, she murmured, patting his knee. Sweetie pie. As a kid, he was called Slick. Catherine called him Teds. One and all called him Father. He liked this new appellation best of all. Maybe one day, maybe, he'd look into trading his Buick for a new model. But certainly nothing brand new. No, no indeed. Chapter 5. The Joke. He drove to the Wesley Mall and looked in the display cases at the jewelry store. His heart sank like a stone. There was absolutely nothing that measured up to the fire and sparkle, the snap and dazzle of his neighbor. He would have a ring made then, fashioned exclusively for Cynthia Coppersmith Cavanaugh. He saw their initials somehow entwined inside the band. C-C-K-T-A-K. But of course he had no earthly idea who to call or where to turn. When someone left a Ross Simon catalog on the table at the post office, he snatched it up and carried it outside to his car, where he pored over the thing until consciousness returned, and he realized he'd sat there with the motor running for a full half hour, steaming in his raincoat like a clam in its shell. I'm sorry, he said, looking at her bare ring finger. If I'd done things right, I would have given you a ring when I proposed.
I don't really want an engagement ring, dearest. Just a simple gold band would be perfect.
You're certain?
Yes, she said. I love simple gold bands.
The image of his mother's wedding band came instantly to mind. It was in his closet, in a box on the shelf, tied by a slender ribbon. He would take it to the store and have it cleaned and engraved and presented at the altar with unspeakable joy and thanksgiving. He felt he was at last beginning to get things right. Uncle Billy Watson brushed the leaves and twigs from last night's storm off the seat of a rusting dinette chair and sat down in the backyard of the Porter House, a.k.a. Mitford's Town Museum. He gazed dolefully into the sea of towering grass that extended to the rear of the house and then beyond his view. The town crew was supposed to mow the grass once every 12 days. By his count, it was 14 going on 15, and a man could get lost out here and not be heard from again. It was a disgrace the way the town put every kind of diddle-daddle ahead of mowing something as proud and fine as their own museum. If he could do it himself, he would, but his arthritis hardly allowed him to get up and down the steps, much less scour a full acre and a quarter with a rusted push-mower. He hoped that when he got to heaven, the Lord would outfit him with a new body and give him a job that required something of a man. But he hadn't come out here to get his dander up. He'd come out to noodle his noggin about a joke to tell at the preacher's wedding, back in that room where they'd all eat cake and ham after the ceremony. Though nobody had said a word about it, the old man knew the preacher would be expecting a joke. He'd be counting on it, and it was his responsibility, his civic duty, to tell the best joke he could come up with. He would never say this to a soul, but it seemed like the preacher getting married so late in life was sort of a joke in itself. It would be a different thing if the father had been married before and had some practice, but as far as anybody knew, he hadn't had any practice. But who was he to judge other people's setups? Half the town thought he was crazy as a bedbug for living with Rose Watson. Even his uncle, who'd come to see them years ago when Rose was still as pretty as a speckled pup, his uncle had said, "They ain't no way I'm understanding how you put up with this mess." Her illness seemed to start right after they married, though he'd witnessed and ignored warning signs from the day they met. For years he'd told himself that it was something he'd done wrong, that he hadn't cherished her like the vows said, and maybe God was punishing them both for his ignorance and neglect. Then the doctors found out about the disease he couldn't spell and could barely pronounce, schizophrenia. On the worst days, he squeezed his eyes shut and remembered the girl he'd seen in the yard of this very house more than, what was it, 45, maybe 50 years ago. She was barefooted and had her hair tied back with a ribbon. Ragged and dirty from working in the fields since daylight, he'd come up from the valley with a wagon load of tomatoes and roasting ears, carrying a sack of biscuits and fried side meat for his dinner. He'd gone around the village, looking for a spot to park his wagon and sell his produce, and saw her standing in her yard. At first he thought she was a statue. Then she moved, and the light fell on her in a certain way, and he called out, "Would you let a man park his wagon on your road?" And she'd walked out to him and smiled at him and nodded. "Get on down," she said. He'd always remember her first words to him. "Get on down." He was ashamed that he wasn't wearing shoes, but then he saw that she wasn't either. She had hung around, looking at him in a way that made him feel uneasy, then happy. And he'd shared his biscuits and side meat with her, and she'd gone in the house and brought out a mason jar of tea, so cold and sweet it hurt his teeth. Between times when customers came and went, she talked about herself more than a little. Her beloved brother, Willard, was dead in the war, buried across the ocean in France, and she was looked after by a woman who paid no attention to her. By early afternoon, he'd sold everything but two tomatoes, which he gave to Rose, who said she'd allow him to park his wagon there next week. They married 18 months later, against the wishes of his family in the valley, whom he never went back to visit. And there he was, a rough valley boy with no education to speak of, married to a girl with a big inheritance, including the finest house in Mitford, and him caning chairs and making birdhouses and doing whatever else he could to hold up his end of the bargain. But he wouldn't go back and do it any different. No, sir. He loved that long-legged girl with the wild eyes more than anything in this world, and could never forget how she used to cling to him and call him Billy Boy and Sweet William and kiss him with all the innocence of a woods violet. His chin dropped to his chest and he jerked awake. Here he was sleeping when he had a job to do. What was the job? For a moment he couldn't remember. Then it came to him. His hand trembled as he propped his cane against the tree. "Lord," he said aloud, "I hope you don't mind me asking you to provide a good joke for the preacher, don't you know?" Mayor Esther Cunningham couldn't help herself. Every time she thought about Father Tim getting married, she thought about the way she and Ray had met and courted, and her eyes misted. She did not like her eyes to mist. She had quit crying years ago when her daddy passed. Whenever she felt like crying, she had learned to turn it inside, where it sometimes felt like a popsicle melting. She had read an article in a magazine at Fancy Skinner's, which said that if you turn sorrow in, it will come out as cancer or something worse, though she couldn't think of anything worse. The article had gone on to say that intimacy with your husband was good for your health, and no matter what else might happen in this life, she and Ray had that in spades. 47 years later, they were still holding hands, just like on their first date. Before Ray, Bobby Prestwood had tried everything to get in her good graces, including making a fool of himself in Sunday school when he stood up one morning and told what he was thankful for.
"I'm thankful for my Chevy V8, my mama and daddy, and Esther Luffel."
She didn't give a Katie what Bobby Prestwood was thankful for, and told him so at the picnic, which was where she met Ray. He had come late with his cousins, carrying a basket of fried chicken and coleslaw, which he'd made himself. She couldn't believe that anybody that big and tall and good-looking could cook, much less chop cabbage. It just amazed her. She had eyed him up and down to see if he was a sissy, but found no evidence of this. When the cousins invited her to sit with them, she accepted, ate 3 pieces of Ray's fried chicken with all the trimmings, and took home a wing wrapped in a napkin. 2 months later, they were married. To this day, she'd never met another woman whose husband rubbed her feet, or maybe people just never mentioned it. And not only did Ray rub her feet after she'd worked like a dog all day and half the night in meetings at town hall, he'd have her supper in the oven, which she sometimes took to bed and ate, sitting up watching TV, with him lying there patting her leg. "Little darling," he might say while he patted. If she ever had to climb in a bed without Ray Cunningham in it, she would die. She would go mort, as Lou Boyd liked to say. She picked up the phone and dialed home.
"Ray?"
She heard Teensy barking in the background.
"Hey, sugar babe, it's hot as blazes today. I'll run you up a jar of lemonade in a little bit. What else you need?"
She wouldn't have told him that all she needed was to hear his voice. Uncle Billy shuffled to the dining room and rifled through stacks of newspaper that the town inspector had threatened to haul off but had forgotten to do. He was after some copies of the Farmer's Almanac that he'd saved for the jokes. Sweat beaded his forehead and upper lip as he worked through the piles, but not a trace of a Farmer's Almanac with its red cover could he find.
Dadgummit! He'd hid things in here for years and always managed to find them, and now not a trace.
He worked his hand around in the pile of Mitford Muses, which occupied a space next to the kitchen door, and felt for the familiar shape of an almanac. What was that? He pulled it out and looked. A $20 bill! He wanted to whoop, but knew better. If Rose got wind of this 20, she'd connive every way in creation to yank it out of him. No, by jing, he'd do something he hardly ever did but often thought about. He'd walk down to the grill and get an order of fries and bring Rose a surprise milkshake. Besides, he'd gotten 2 or 3 of his best jokes at the grill. Maybe that was where he'd find this one. Careful to put the 20 in the pants pocket without the hole, he abandoned the search for the almanacs and instituted a hurried quest for any other currency he'd once hidden in the vicinity. Luella Baxter Marshall sat by the window in the sewing room, now her bedroom, at Fernbank, looking at the catalog. The light was good in here, and she could clearly see the picture of the dress she'd be wearing to the wedding. After 2 days of praying about it, and going back and forth from page 42 to page 47, she had showed Miss Sadie her pick. "Green or lavender?" she asked her lifelong friend and sister in Christ. Miss Sadie didn't hesitate.
"Lavender," she said. "You always look good in lavender."
Miss Sadie was a little bit like a mama, for it was Miss Sadie who knew Luella's history, who said things like,
"When you were a baby, you hated apple butter."
Or, "I remember the time I pulled you to town in the wagon. You hopped out and chased Perry Mackey down the street for a lick on his peppermint stick. You nearly scared him to death." Luella didn't remember any of the events Miss Sadie liked to recall, but she'd heard them so often, they'd become as good as real memories. She savored the image of chasing a little white boy down the street to lick his candy, and wondered why on earth she loved apple butter now if she hated it then.
"How do you know I always look good in this color?"
"When you were about 6 years old, Mama made you a lavender dress with smocking on the bodice. Don't you remember it, with little pearl buttons? It was such a pretty dress. I was half jealous."
She was disgusted with herself for not remembering.
"Don't you think this big white collar too fancy for my face?"
"Posh, tosh, your face may be too fancy for that collar."
They had both laughed and laughed, and then they zeroed in on the business of Miss Sadie's final choice. Page 36 was too drab. Page 37 was too high in the waist. Page 40 was not only shapeless, it had three-quarter-length sleeves, which, as anybody knew, were unflattering all the way back to the Pharaohs. Page 41, however, showed promise.
"I like the way it's cut," said Miss Sadie, peering at the dress through a magnifying glass. "But I'm too gray-headed for this color."
"Why, listen at that. Gray-headed is what looked good with blue."
"But it's pale blue, and it might wash me out."
"No, honey, you might wash it out."
They had laughed again like children and decided on the pale blue French crepe with smocked bodice. Luella held the catalog closer to the window and squinted at the picture. She wished Moses Marshall could see her all dressed up for the father's wedding. He would look at her and be so proud. Oh, how she'd loved that man from the day she laid eyes on him. She closed her eyes to rest them and held the picture against her heart and saw her husband-to-be walking into the kitchen of the Atlanta boarding house. She was 15 years old, with her hair in cornrows and the sense that something wonderful was about to happen. Moses Marshall flashed a smile that nearly knocked her winding. She had never seen anybody who looked like this when she was growing up in Mitford. The only people of color in Mitford were old and stooped over.
"Who's one baked them good biscuits for supper?"
he asked. She'd been scarcely able to speak.
"What you want to know for?"
"'Cause the one that baked them good biscuits, that's the one I'm going to marry."
She had looked at old Miss Sally Lou, who had to stand on tiptoe to peer into a pot on the stove. She was so little and dried up, some said she was 100. But Luella knew she was only 82, and still the boss cook of 3 meals a day at the boarding house. She had pointed to Miss Sally Lou, afraid to say the plain truth, that she, Luella Baxter, had baked the biscuits herself, 3 pans full, and not one left begging. Moses Marshall looked his bright, happy look at Miss Sally Lou, and walked over and picked her up and swung her around twice before he set her down like a doll.
"Fine biscuits, ma'am. Will you jump the broom with me?"
"Get out of my way before I knock you in the head," said Miss Sally Lou. "Marry that un yonder. She the one do biscuits. I does yeast rolls."
She was 16 when they were married at her grandmother's house in Atlanta, where she'd gone to live after leaving Mitford. Her grandmother had cooked the wedding feast, which was topped off with fresh peach cobbler.
"Why eat cake when you can eat cobbler?" was what her grandmother always said.
Her years with Moses had been the happiest years of her life, next to those with Miss Sadie. But the Lord had taken Moses home when he was just 39, and then he'd taken her precious boy in a terrible wreck, leaving her a grandson living in Los Angeles. She looked out to the green orchard and nodded her head and smiled.
"Moses Marshall," she said, "I invite you to sit with me at the wedding, and don't be pitching and kissing on me in front of the good Lord and everybody."
Dooley Barlow was trying to be happy, but he figured he didn't know what that was supposed to mean. He felt around inside himself, around the area of his heart, maybe, and tried to see if he could make things seem good and right about Father Tim and Cynthia getting married. He'd seen what happened when people lived together under the same roof. They yelled and screamed and fought and said terrible things to each other. He'd seen his daddy go at his mama with a butcher knife more than once, and after his daddy ran off, he'd seen his mama leave for 2 and 3 days at a time
and depend on him to mind the kids and feed them without any money to buy stuff with.
He remembered stealing a pork loin from the grocery store and getting it home and not knowing how to cook it. He had dropped it in a pot of boiling water with oatmeal and let it cook till the water boiled out on the stove. Then he carved the meat in 5 chunks, and they tried to eat it and got so sick he thought they'd all die in the night. Once he'd stolen 5 cans of creamed corn so they could all have exactly the same thing and not fight over who got what and how much. And the store manager had caught him and jumped on him really bad. But he'd let him have the corn, saying if he ever did it again, he'd be sent to the penitentiary. A woman who overheard the commotion had gone and gotten a can of Harvard beets, a loaf of Wonder Bread, a pound of M&Ms, and a quart of buttermilk, and gave the items to him in a plastic bag. He remembered that he couldn't stomach buttermilk, and the kids wouldn't drink it either, but they couldn't bear to throw it out, and it sat in the refrigerator for maybe a year. He didn't like to think about these things. He wanted to forget everything that had ever happened before he came here, but sometimes he couldn't. He especially wanted to forget about his little sister, Jessie, because thinking of her being gone and nobody knowing where made him want to cry. And he tried to keep his face as hard and tight and straight as possible so nobody would ever be able to tell what he was thinking. Sometimes, at night especially, he remembered trying to help his mama when she was drunk and would suddenly feel a great love for her welling up in him. Then he'd be angry with himself for being stupid and feel the old and shameful desire for her to die. Things were just fine for him and Father Tim. He felt safe, finally, like things would be all right. But now he didn't know what would happen. He liked Cynthia, but what if she didn't like him? What if she tried to get him to leave or go back to his mother, if anybody could even find his mother? Or what if Cynthia tried to be his mother? His heart felt cold at such a thought. He wanted his own mother, even if he did hate her and wish he would never see her again as long as he lived. He was glad that Barnabas came to his room and jumped on the foot of his bed, because it felt good to have a friend. Besides, Barnabas would never tell anyone that he was crying and couldn't stop. Chapter 6. The Letter. His heart was nearly bursting with a kind of longing, though he had no idea why. After all, he was blessed with everything this life could afford, everything and more. He sat at his desk in the study and looked out the window into the gloaming as it settled over Baxter Park. Cynthia was working on an illustration that had to go out tomorrow by FedEx, or he would have been at her side, as magnetized to her living presence as his grocery list to the refrigerator. He drummed his fingers on the desktop. He didn't want to work on his sermon. He didn't want to take a shower and crawl into bed with a well-loved book from his well-stocked shelves. And he most certainly did not want to turn on the TV and have the clamor pour into this quiet place like some foul Niagara. He was unable to think of anything he wanted to do. There was no seduction in any of the usual pursuits. Aha! His fingers grew still upon the desktop. There it was, plain as day. He wanted to record, somehow, the joy of this breathless thing that had swept him up and overpowered and mesmerized him. Perhaps for most people, people who had been in love again and again, it would not be such a beauteous experience. But it was new to him, and dazzling. Yet even in its newness, he felt it slipping away, becoming part of a personal history in which the nuances, the shading, would be lost forever. Buried within the consciousness, yes, but paled by time, and then, he feared, vanished altogether. He opened the desk drawer and took out a writing pad and one of the commercial pens he'd grown to prefer. Though the ink had a noxious odor, he liked the way it flowed onto the page, black, bold, and able. He knew now what his soul was driving him to. He knew and he liked the idea immensely. He would write a poem. In it, he would tell her everything. He would confess the all of his love, which, by its great and monumental force, had heretofore rendered him dumb as a mackerel. With her, he experienced a galaxy, no, an entire universe of feelings, yet they continually displayed themselves as the western portion of the state of Rhode Island. You are beautiful to me. I shall love you eternally. Will you marry me and make me the happiest man who ever drew breath? Period. End of declaration. He was amazed at how far he'd gotten with this extraordinary woman by the utterance of the most rudimentary expressions of love, all of them sincere beyond measure, and yet they were words too simple and words too few. Not once had they been equal to the character, the beauty, or the spirit of the one to whom they were addressed. He knew now why people wanted to shout from rooftops, yet he couldn't imagine it to have great effect in the end. One would clamber onto the roof and, teetering on some gable or chimney pot, bellow until one was hoarse as a bullfrog, "I love! I love!" And what would people on the street do? They would look up, they would shrug, they would roll their eyes, they would say, "So?" He bounded happily from the chair and went to the kitchen to put the kettle on. Clearly, shouting from the rooftops had been a fleeting thing in the history of the love-struck, not long enjoyed as a certified expression of ardor. Indeed, what had done the trick each and every time? Poetry. And history had proved it. "I love thee," he recited as he filled the kettle, "to the level of every day's most quiet need, by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely, as men strive for right." There, that was getting down to it. The only problem was that E.B. Browning had already written it. He stood musing by the stove in a kind of fog that made him forget momentarily where he was and what he was up to, until the kettle whistled and he awoke and found himself oddly joyful to be dropping the bags into the teapot and pouring the steaming water therein. He clamped the lid on the pot, and, leaving it to the business of steeping, returned to the study and visited his bookshelves. He couldn't readily put his hand on a volume of love poetry, but surely he'd find something here to spark a thought, to get his blood up. He chose a small blue volume that he'd used a time or two in marital counseling, and opened it at random. "I feel sad when I don't see you," he read aloud from a letter by a 19th-century American suitor. "Be married, why won't you? And come to live with me. I will make you as happy as I can. You shall not be obliged to work hard, and when you are tired, you may lie in my lap, and I will sing you to rest." "There's a good fellow," he thought. "Because I love you so well, I will not make you bring in wood and water, or feed the pig, or milk the cow, or go to the neighbor's to borrow milk. Will you be married?" He shoved the book upon the shelf, took down another, and thumbed through the section on all things marital. "I love you no longer. On the contrary, I detest you." Napoleon Bonaparte to Josephine. Wrong section. Ah, well, here was one for the books, something Evelyn Waugh had trotted out in a letter of proposal. "I can't advise you in my favor, because I think it would be beastly for you, but think how nice it would be for me." Would it be beastly for Cynthia, living with him, an old stick in the mud? He shook the thought away and licked his right forefinger and turned to another page. "You have set a crown of roses on my youth and fortified me against the disaster of our days. Your courageous gaiety has inspired me with joy. Your tender faithfulness has been a rock of security and comfort. I have felt for you all kinds of love at once. I have asked much of you, and you have never failed me. You have intensified all colors, heightened all beauty, deepened all delight." Duff Cooper, writing to his future wife in the war-dark year of 1918, had known how to get down to brass tacks all right. Maybe he could do something with the idea of courageous gaiety. He had always thought Cynthia courageous. He sighed deeply. In truth, this was going nowhere. It was a waste of precious time to try and glean from another man's brain. There'd be no more lollygagging. He dashed again to the kitchen and poured a mug of tea, then added a little milk and stirred it well, and returned to his desk and sat, gazing at the mug, the pad, and the pen, and the nightfall, dark against his window. He considered that he had written hymns to God, several in his time, but he'd never done anything like this. Never. He knew that God was familiar with his very innards, and that he perceived the passion of his heart full well. Thus, he had not sweated greatly over lines that were awkward here or a tad sophomoric there, but this... "Right!" he bellowed aloud. Barnabas bolted from the rug by the sofa and trotted to his master and stood by the desk. The rector turned his head slowly, and for a moment each looked soulfully into the other's eyes. "Dearest love," he wrote at last, "tender one, my heart's joy." He drew a line through the feeble words and began again. "Loveliest angel of light and life." What about something from the Song of Solomon? On second thought, scratch that. The song still made him blush. Whoever drummed up the notion that it was about Christ and the church? He nibbled his right forefinger and mused upon lines from Shakespeare. He chewed his lower lip and called to mind Keats. He sank his head onto his arms on the desktop and contemplated Robert Browning's fervent avowal, "All my soul follows you, love, and I live in being yours." Blast and double blast. But good stuff had already been written. He talked to himself with some animation as he trotted up Main Street from Lord's Chapel. What if Shakespeare had never put pen to paper because all the good stuff had already been written? In truth, what if he refused one morning to preach because all the good sermons had already been preached? Ha! On the other side of the Irish shop's display window, Minnie Lomax examined the bent head and hunched shoulders of the village priest as he blew past, his mouth moving in what she supposed was prayer. He didn't look at all like a man besotted with love, not in her view. Why was he staring at the sidewalk when he might be looking into the heavens, or whistling, or waving to her through the window as he usually did? He was scared of what he'd let himself in for, that's what. 60-something and getting married for the first time? The very thought gave her the shivers. She had never married, and never wanted to. Well, not never, exactly. She had wanted to once, and look what happened. She sniffed and smoothed her cardigan over her thin hips, and took a Kleenex from her pocket and blew her nose, then turned around to the empty store, wondering what she might do to lure traffic through the door today. Boiled wool had a terrible go of it during the summer. Next year, she would advise the owner to put in more cotton and linen, for heaven's sake, and get shed of the entire lot of those hideous crocheted caps. He would choose each word as carefully as his mother had chosen peaches off Lot Stringman's truck.
"Let me pick them out for you, Miss Cavanaugh."
"No, thank you, Mr. Stringman," she would say. "I like the doing of it myself." Finally, despairing that writing a poem was beyond his endowment, he had decided to be content with writing a letter. Peach by perfect peach. That is how he would choose his words. Sunday afternoon, 4 o'clock, a breeze stirring through the open windows. My own. Consider how these two small words have the power to move and shake me and take my breath away. I am raised to a height I have never before known. Somewhere above the clouds that hide the mountain-rimmed valleys and present a view of floating peaks. I have been comfortable for years, haplessly rooted in myself like a turnip, and now am not comfortable at all, but stripped of everything that is easeful and familiar, and filled with everything that is tremulous and alive. I am a spring lamb upon new legs. Every nerve is exposed to you, my dearest love, and my thankfulness for this gift from God knows no bounds, no bounds. Indeed, he has saved the best for last, and that he should have saved it at all, set it aside for me, is a miracle. A miracle! Let no one ever say or even think that God does not work miracles still. Every common day, every